The Art and Energy Collective are a group of artists, makers, thinkers and tinkerers who want to use their skills to respond to the climate emergency. They specialise in designing mass participation artworks that help people connect with nature and take steps towards a brighter, greener future. In 2024, Art and Energy Collective were commissioned by Bricks to deliver a public art programme for people local to the new residential development at Brick Kiln Court in eastern Bristol. The programme responds to the historic use of the site as one of the largest collieries in East Bristol and explores themes of energy use, sustainability and the climate crisis. Their latest mass participation artwork, the Mossy Carpet, is made of thousands of individually created mosses made from pom-poms and textile tufts, adorning a large length of felt from Dartmoor. Inspired by moss, each pom-pom represents someone's small action to combat climate change. Within the artwork are electronic sensors and stuffed textile tardigrades that play recordings of participants' voices, so as you stroke the artwork, you hear about the things that other people are doing. And we'll be hearing some of those messages later in the episode. We spoke to collective members Chloe, Naomi and Jenny about climate, creativity, collective action and moss, as well as bryologist Matt Stribley and executive director of the Climate Coalition, Helen Meach.
I'm Chloe and I am the founder and one of the directors of the Art and Energy Collective, and we are a group of artists and makers who want to use our skills to respond to the climate emergencies. We specialise in designing participatory artworks, that is, artworks that involve lots of people in making the art. And our aim is to help people take creative steps towards a brighter, greener future. Basically, we're trying to help people find and embrace their creativity for a better way of life.
I'm Naomi Wright, and I am an artist and environmentalist or ecologist in the Art and Energy Collective. And my role reflects my interest in connecting people with nature and the link between art and science. So I encourage the projects to develop interest in both the arts and the sciences, but in specifically the living energy systems that exist and make the world go round.
I'm one of four artists that have been working on this project, part of which is to make this massive, epic mossy carpet. And it's inspired by mosses, inspired by all the tiny actions that mosses take to make our environment better in the face of the climate emergency. But we're really enjoying looking at the diversity of the mosses and making pom-poms in an adventure playground in Bristol called the Felix Road Adventure Playground. And this is half term and it's open, and there are all sorts of people here, all ages, really enjoying relaxing with us and finding out a bit about bosses and finding out about how to make pom-poms and stitch and manage textiles, as well as think about what they do to make the environment better, think about climate change a bit, have conversations that are about sharing and inspiring each other.
The Mossy Carpet Project is a project that invites people to seek inspiration from mosses, and it also invites people to celebrate tiny actions in response to the climate emergency. And it arrived out of the last mass participation project that we ran. So for COP26, which was back in 2021, we created a mass participation artwork with around 58,000 people. And we created an installation at Glasgow's Botanic Garden. The artwork was called Moths to a Flame. And it was exploring the world of moths, inviting people to discover the magic and wonder of moths that are relatively unseen. And to consider how a moth's relationship with light can be devastating and damaging to its well-being. And we were seeing a parallel in our own relationship with energy and our own addiction and dependency on our existing energy systems. And we were seeing that that similarly has effects on our well-being, our mental health, and that of the biodiversity in the world around us. And while we were in the Kibble Palace, we had delegates and visitors and ministers and speakers and all sorts of people who were involved in COP coming through. And the endless conversation was about carbon trading and carbon sequestration and all sorts of aspects of carbon that we felt were really inaccessible to the average person. We felt that the sorts of solutions that were being discussed were things that were beyond most people's ability to participate in. And that made us feel a bit powerless, and it made us feel like, well, you know, it just triggered lots of that eco-anxiety stuff that comes forward when you confront what we now call the giant, the climate change and ecological emergency giant of our time. And while we were sitting there contemplating this artwork that we'd made and displayed, and we were thinking about what on earth we were going to do next, we found ourselves looking at mosses, and we began to listen to the stories that were being told around mosses.
I'm Matt Stribley. I'm a bryologist. That's someone who studies mosses and liverworts. And I have a recorder for Cornwall, and I was a silly for the British Bryological Society. So I go out in the field and study mosses, look at them, identify them, give them little names, and just keep records of where they're growing. It sort of gives you a lot of pleasure and sort of satisfaction. You look at a carpet of moss growing, even if it's on a wall in the town, and it's like a little forest, and you start get your magnifying glass out and start examining the little plants growing, and it's just fascinating. You know, I study them in a bit more detail, have a nice microscope, and you get a leaf of moss and pop it under the microscope, and it's another world, and you sort of can get lost lost in the forest, so to speak.
The importance of moss to the environment, it's just vast and unbelievable, really. Moss grows all over the planet, between paving stones, obviously, but also on top of mountains and in deserts and under glaciers and on glaciers and so on. It will live almost anywhere.
They were some of the first plants that came out of the water and started living on land, sort of evolved from the algae, really, which were already in the water, which still are today. And they've been with us such a long time and lived through a number of extinction events. And I think mosses just sort of show that sort of how they're adapted to all sorts of environments.
Because it's been on the planet for such a long time, 450, 500 million years, all that time it's been nurturing the environmental conditions in so many ways and being adaptable and resilient to change as well. So the sorts of things that it does for the environment, this is all around the planet, are things like creating soil. So without the tiniest mosses, the smallest plants on the planet, you wouldn't get the soil formation that's initially from the minerals and so on, from the hard surfaces of rocks, and then the organic nature of the plant itself gradually creating soils. And without soils, you don't get all the other living forms starting to grow.
They're quite different to our ordinary flowering plants. So the flowering plants sort of developed on from mosses and grow taller, have flowers, have pollen, and do different things. And whereas the mosses have remained a little bit more like they were when they first evolved. And so we have spores, which, you know, very small, quite different. They're not, are not so sort of so efficient, really. So, but it's quite amazing how mosses are still here, when like the spores aren't as efficient as a seed, which is really puzzling, but they're very, mosses are very adaptive.
Mosses can sequester more carbon than all the forests on the planet, and especially the peatland areas with the sphagnum moss, the boggy pompon moss, as we call it.
The mosses are also quite magical in terms of that they can reproduce from fragments of the leaf. And some of the mosses also have little tubers and little potatoes on the roots. So they don't actually have roots as plants, as flowering plants do. They're rhizoids, but they have little potatoes, and those can reproduce from those as well. So it's a whole, it's quite interesting. There's a whole lot more that could be said about that.
All those things make it really significant. It has a massive impact on the planet for its size.
And the smallness we felt was really accessible. We felt like this, the smallness reflected the smallness that we can all feel when we confront the climate giant. And there are all sorts of kind of ancient wisdom sayings that say, you know, when you're confronting something that's overwhelming, look at the tiny. And there's something extraordinarily comforting and magical about taking out a hand lens and going into those mossy forests and looking for the lessons that feel relevant to you in your own life, and celebrating each of those small things that we can do in our own life feels really important.
My name's Helen Meach, and I'm Executive Director at the Climate Coalition. We are the biggest group of organisations in the UK coming together to push for action on nature and climate. We're a membership coalition. Our members range from large household name organisations like the National Trust, Save the Children, Oxfam, through to community organisations who are taking action for nature and climate in their communities. Collective action is at the heart of the Climate Coalition strategy, and is at the heart of what our members come together to platform and mobilise our supporters and networks to do. And collective action is, we believe, the most powerful way that we can create change, because the core belief that sits at the heart of our work as a coalition is that people are powerful, especially when we come together. And when we come together, we can make amazing things happen. If you look at some of like the most powerful changes in our history, both here in the UK and globally, they often at their heart came from a group that came together to create change. So the NHS evolved from a small group of people that came together to look at how healthcare might be better provided. Social movements around the world and throughout history have created huge change. So collective action is really powerful.
One of the aspects of the breakdown and the way that we live is a disconnectedness from land and a disconnectedness from community. And that can result in you feeling like you're alone and like you're the only one doing anything. And, you know, why should I do this when so-and-so over there is never going to care? And it's one of the main things that creates stagnation and increases traction and just makes an energized response to the climate emergency less possible.
On your own, you might feel like you don't have much of a voice, but by coming together, we build power. Together, we are more powerful because it's much more influential if a group of people do something together or are calling for something together than just a sole voice. So there's huge power in coming together. There's something about belonging. Like if you can find your tribe, find other people that care about the same things that you do and are working on the same things as you, it motivates you to do more.
Some of our environmental changes that we face are just so huge that working individually is overwhelming, but it feels too much. I mean, I think it's important to address it with lots of individual skills that reflecting off each other, creating a sort of synergy so that it's having a bigger impact than its size. The subtle differences between us mean that teamwork just is so much more effective.
That opportunity to have positive exchanges with other people is essential, because, you know, we're born into the cultures that we're born into. We're born into the experience of life that we are, and we learn what we learn. And there is something that is extremely good of meeting people that we don't know, sharing experiences that we don't have experience of yet. And the arts are a really, really good way of helping people encounter the new and the strange in a way that feels really safe. So, for example, I grew up in countries where English wasn't the predominant language. And in that process of learning other languages, the arts were really helpful, because I could do a drawing or a painting or, you know, sing a song and find that there was something that was beyond language that connected me with other people and helped form the basis of community. And I think that that thing of having strong communities, but also having opportunities like festivals and arts events where you bring people together from different communities to get to know each other better, to share better, is invaluable.
Another aspect to being a collective is this breaking down of boundaries. So important, and it's been a passion of mine all my career, working on the edge of different sectors and making invitations or crossing those borders, which other people, other colleagues didn't do or don't do, and getting the conversations across those boundaries is the way to make change, make a difference. It's the way we work, and it's what collective working is about.
The Climate Coalition's been working on the Show the Love campaign for nearly 10 years now. And it centres the green heart at the centre of the campaign. And it's all around people calling for action on nature and climate to protect the things that they love. Whether that is a place that's particularly important to them, a part of the natural world that's particularly important to them, a species that they love, or whether that's they're thinking about their children, their grandchildren, their friends and family. It's all about protecting the things and the places that we love. We've centred craftivism as part of the campaign, because craftivism is a powerful way of demonstrating love. You know, creating a green heart, whether it's from paper, whether you've created it from fabrics and textiles, there's a lot of love that goes into creating a green heart. And so it really mirrors, you know, we're calling upon politicians and other decision makers with power to take robust action for nature and climate. And we're doing it in a way that shows, you know, we're basically saying, please do this for the things that we love, but also we're putting a lot of love into the things that are crafted, which are then sent to politicians and calling for that change.
My view is that nature, all of us, are living beings. It is a living surface to the earth, and it relies on the sun, the wind, you know, the air, the earth, water. And the more we get to grips with how it works and absorbing it, its potential, the more we also can understand the natural energy force that we could use instead of fossil fuels. We evolved with nature, and nature is sort of in us and part of us. And I think the human condition relies on nature being core to our bodies and ourselves and our lives.
I think it's really important to centre nature in any conversation about climate for a number of different reasons. So one is that even if you live in the most built up inner city, you are going out into looking at the sky above you, you know, feeling the wind on your face, noticing kind of the trees around you. So it's much more tangible for people than thinking about carbon emissions or net zero. So I think nature is a really brilliant way to bring people in and get them to start thinking about climate and some of the things that that we need to tackle as a society. I think the second thing is that a sense of connection to nature is incredibly powerful for a number of reasons. So the more connected you are to nature, the more likely you are willing to take action for it. If you are more connected to nature and you feel part of nature, any damage to the natural world and the environment, you see as damaging yourself. And so therefore you are more strongly motivated to act. But from a climate anxiety perspective, I think thinking about nature is also really powerful, because if you are more connected to nature, it's been proven by psychologists to reduce levels of anxiety, reduce levels of stress. It promotes feelings of kind of feeling good and functioning well, which I think are sort of directly linked to a sense of hope.
We wanted to kind of make an artwork that was going to have a sense of hope, have a sense of recognition of the individual's worth, even at the tiniest scale, even at the youngest or the oldest or the frailest or the strongest, you know, that's celebrating everyone's action and creating a piece of artwork that really captured the sense of glory that comes with realizing that actually you're not alone. And actually, there are lots of people out there who are doing really exciting things and really meaningful things. And some of those things you might want to know about yourself, because they're things that you could live with in your own life. They're things that you could do. And I feel like anything that we can pay attention to, we're going to grow. Anything we can pay attention to, we're going to give strength to. And so if we can, through this artwork, give each other attention, we give each other strength and support and encouragement, that's something that we really need at this time.
There's an incredible American author called Rebecca Solnit that writes about hope, and she talks about authentic hope. So hope is not optimism, because optimists think it's all going to be okay and thereby excuse themselves from acting. Pessimists think it's all too difficult and all too late, and so excuse themselves from acting. For me, authentic hope is acting. Because in acting, we have agency, we build power, and we can create change.
So we know from the Centre for Climate Change that as we face the climate and ecological emergencies, we do have technical solutions that we can use as a society and a culture in response to the climate emergency. But we know that at least 50%, according to them, of the changes that are required are changes in behaviour and changes in the ways that we live our life. And it is very difficult to change habits and change the way you live. What we have found over the years of working in nature infrastructure and working in renewable energy and the sorts of things that we've been doing around the technical response to the climate emergency is that behaviour change is much more complex than maybe is given credit for. You can't just ask someone to do something and expect them to do it. You have to find meaning, and you have to find the energy, and you have to have the capacity to change, and you have to, you know, you have to be able to imagine that it's possible, and you have to be supported. And unless you have all of those things, you can find yourself in quite a eco-anxious situation or a passive situation. And so the thing that participatory art does, which is quite exciting, is that it engages people actively in doing and growing simple things that explore meaning and that make you feel capable and help you find what makes sense for you in your life.
We are inviting people to celebrate the small actions that they're taking for the future, and part of that is in the hope that by sharing the things that we're doing, those things then become normal and doable and achievable, and it encourages other people to adopt more of those small changes that are achievable in everyday life by hearing other people's messages. So we've got something called the tardigrade telephone. So we've called it the tardigrade telephone because we were inspired by the creatures that live in the mosses. There are lots of absolutely tiny microscopic creatures, rotifers, nematodes, and tardigrades. And tardigrades we were particularly excited by, in a similar way to the moss, where the moss can dry right out and wait for the rain, and when it rains they then ping back to life in a way that a lot of plants aren't that hardy and that resilient. Tardigrades that live amongst the mosses, they can do the same thing. So when they dry out, or if conditions aren't suitable for them, then they go into a form of stasis, and then when the conditions are right again, they wiggle and come back to life. So scientists have actually taken them up into space, exposed them to the radiation, sun's radiation and the vacuum of space. And when they brought the tardigrades back down to Earth, not all of them, but the vast majority of them kept on wiggling. And so they're so resilient. And we just feel that there's quite a lot we can learn from tardigrades with our changing world in order to cope and to adapt to what is to come.
I think you really have a job to see them with your naked eye. But if you look under a microscope, they're quite obvious. And I always feel sorry for the little things when I see them under my microscope slide, and you see little eyes popping up at you. And they're called sort of moss piglets, the water bears, for a very good reason, because you look at their legs and they've got these, and the shape of the body and their little eyes, and you see them crawling around quite slowly, and you think, oh, the poor little things. But they've been with us for a very long time as well. I think it's as long as mosses, or is it longer in terms of, you know, time on Earth? But they're certainly an extremely durable little beast. And they have this sort of way that they can sort of shut the metabolism down and sort of go into this state where they call themselves a ton. And they can sort of stay like that for years. And they sort of dehydrate themselves and almost go into sort of almost nothing. But then as soon as they're put into the right environment with some water, within sort of half an hour or so, they can start coming back to life and almost functioning as if nothing's happened. Only we could do that.
The tardigrade telephone is made out of an old retro rotary dial telephone. It's got a teensy controller inside and wired up so that the messages that are recorded on the telephone go onto a little SD card. And then the plan is that the carpet with all the mossy pom-poms and textile tufts that people have made. In amongst those, there are going to be some which have conductive thread, and those will act as sensors. So we really want to encourage people to get hands-on and to touch, to feel, to interact with the carpet. But when they do so, they will then trigger audio messages to play back to them, and those will be from people who've participated in the workshops. And also anybody out there can do that, because the tardigrade not only has these rotary telephones but also has a mobile number, so you can send a WhatsApp voice message, or you can phone it and leave a voicemail on there. So when you interact with the carpet, you'll then hear these messages play back, and hopefully there'll maybe be something that you hear and you think, oh, I hadn't thought of doing that, but if that person can do it, then maybe I should give it a go, or could give it a go. Or maybe there'll be other things that you hear and you think, I'm already doing that, but I didn't even realise that was a positive thing for the environment. And then it encourages people to keep on doing those things and doing the stuff that's great for the environment and for a brighter, greener future.
My pledge is to put more wildflowers in my garden.
I'm part of my school's eco club. At the moment, we're organising a clothes swap to promote reusing clothes rather than throwing stuff away and buying new stuff.
Hello, tardigrade. I'm going to do more recycling.
Instilling my daughter with hope about the future and making her feel like she can make a difference.
And I love butterflies because it is my favourite. I'm Phoebe.
Hi, I love nature. I have planted an oak tree and I look after bees. Thank you.
We love the environment.
Hello, Mr. Tardigrade. I am going to try to pick up more litter and I am not eating any meat anymore.
I'm trying to encourage my mum and dad to get an electric car to stop putting all the fumes into the world.
I do lots of gardening and pick up rubbish wherever I go.
I've been cutting down on meat.
We go to the beach with my little boys, Maxie and Aubrey, and we take a bag and we tidy up all the rubbish and we take it home with us and then we recycle it.
And also we plant new plants in our garden, loads of new plants.
I'm going walking.
My name is Amelia. I think you should stop littering right now to make the world a better planet.
I ride my bike to places.
we need to try to walk instead of driving to places, because it reduces like carbon dioxide getting released into the atmosphere.
Reduce, reuse, recycle.
I make people feel happy.
I think the nature is great, but look out for cows.
I would like the world to be nice and green.
This work has been or is being about the power that we have within ourselves to deliver stuff. And we're hoping that all this connecting and conversations will help develop a project that the next one will be perhaps about, specifically about the collaboration and the connecting and the communities, and what the power within can do by joining with others.
The Mossy Carpet is now a project that we have really significant ambitions for and really exciting ambitions for. So we've raised some funding through crowdfunding to grow the carpet, and our ambition is to include over 100,000 people in this new artwork and to create a piece that is at least 100 metres long and capturing the voices of many, many people and sharing those voices. And in an interactive piece that really shows how much support there is for climate action and support for each other. Our aim at the moment is to try and find a way of taking it to COP29, not to leave the UK for COP29, but to use it within the UK context within COP29, in order to reiterate the aims and the aspirations for the project and to invite people to get involved. And we can imagine considering taking it overseas to COP30. We have this appetite to go through the doors that open, to go where the energy is, and to respond to people in our community and to respond to what people want and need. And so we will try and stay open to and not too controlling about what happens next. So if anyone has any ideas for how they think that they'd like us to use the Mossy Carpet or how they could use the Mossy Carpet themselves, that would be really fantastic.
Looking to the future, my hopes for the Climate Coalition is that that we can encourage the next government. It's a general election year. I couldn't do this podcast interview without talking about that. You know, there's going to be an election, and whatever the outcome of that election, I hope that in the run-up to the election, we can make that public mandate for robust action on nature and climate really clear, to really bust the perceptions that people don't care and not willing to act. There's a huge amount of evidence now, both from within the UK and internationally, that it's 86% of people want robust action. So like that's like irrefutable public mandate for change. So my real hope is that the next government will act on that public mandate, and that as a coalition we can continue to keep the pressure up on politicians, on business leaders and others in power, to take the action that we so urgently need.
The How to Bury the Giant project inspires a sort of lens of metaphor and hope to make a difference in the world. I like to work optimistically with hope and encourage people to think that there is a place for them to work in their own way, maybe small, maybe big, but in their own way to make their world a better place.
We're really keen to allow anyone anywhere to join in whatever way they'd like to. So we have a whole set of free resources on our website, and that includes videos, activity books, instructions, and places to post and send pom-poms, so that people can join in the way that works for them. So I'd love to invite anyone to have a look at that, make a pom-pom, send us a message, and join in over the next year and a half. Our website is www.artandenergy.org.
This episode was produced by Rowan Bishop, with thanks to Chloe, Naomi and Jenny at the Art and Energy Collective, to Matt and Helen for their valuable insights, and a special thanks to staff and children at Raised in Bristol Felix Road, Eastside Community Trust and Felix Road Adventure Playground, as well as the local community in and around Brick Kiln Court, Easton. Thanks for listening. We're Bricks, a social enterprise with a mission to support creative communities in Bristol, helping them to thrive. We work with communities, developers and local artists to produce programmes that support both local voices and Bristol's creative economy. If you would like to get in touch, learn more about Bricks public art producing or find out more about the artwork discussed in this podcast, please visit bricksbristol.org and follow us for updates on all the usual social channels. To be the first to hear when we release new podcast episodes, be sure to subscribe to our feed, and if you enjoyed this episode, feel free to leave us a review.